The simpler and more common jajim includes stripes 1 to 5 centimeters wide of different colors. Sometimes, to create a checkered pattern, colorful wraps are used. Traditionally, though, jajim is woven on a horizontal loom with colorful fine threads of wool and usually by a single weaver. Both sides of the jajim can be used, which is why it has become a multi-purpose article, often quilted and used as a cover or blanket, and sometimes even spread on the ground. The taste and talent of these people can also be seen through the designs of their earthenware. Pottery is perhaps the earliest and most important invention of mankind in Iran, dating back to the 7th millennium BC. In the small town of Khusf, not much has changed since the invention of the potter's wheel. Symmetry is omnipresent in Persian craftsmanship. The detailed patterns of the 7,000-year-old art of marquetry are no exception. When it comes to decorating your home traditionally, wooden lattice doors and windows with stained glass are things you simply can't miss. The number of wooden pieces needed for each door is striking. It is usually beechwood or sycamore that is considered the best for refined carving at this level.
Woodwork like this dates back at least 1,500 years. Some historians say it even dates back to the Sassanid era. So I guess we have to admit that there's at least a little bit something to the Persian old saying that art only belongs to Iranians.
Gisu Misha Ahmadi for Iran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Greetings, everyone. This is Iran Radio, broadcasting from the bustling capital of Tehran. We are ready to share more programs for the next hour. Let's check out the next lineup. Our next program is Dialogue. This program offers a unique look at the most important conversations and dialogues between Shia infallible imams and their followers, questioners, and leaders of different Islamic faith and sects on various religious topics, doctrines, and also political, social, and cultural issues. Then we have Israel Watch. This program offers a critical look at Zionist media narratives and their views on West Asia. Hosted from Beirut, an expert guest joins for engaging discussions, challenging biased reports, and shedding light on Israel's actions in occupied Palestine. Next up, Ulema's speech shares scholarly wisdom. Following that, we have Round the World with Reporters. Stay with us for the next program, Dialogue.
Why there is a need for a government which will be established by the Wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghibah.
Let us see how one can prepare for the advent of the zuhur of Imam Mahdi, Sahib al-Zaman.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Please stay tuned. The
the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is the one who brings hope to all of humanity. As the world is being grinded between the oppressors and tyrants of the age, we look towards the heavens so that the advent of the 12th divinely appointed Imam comes sooner. We raise our hands in prayers and we raise our hands in supplications so that the awaited Savior of humanity comes and brings the final hope and salvation that humanity is so yearning for and desiring. The sights and the eyes of the world are looking towards the advent of this great Savior, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance so that his eminence comes to establish the divine rule of the Almighty Allah for every single human being, is completely dependent and needs this divine rule of the Almighty Allah. And it is this divine rule of the Almighty Allah, the kingdom of God that is to be established by Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, which will bring about ultimate justice in a world which is filled with cruelty and injustice. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. So, dear friends, we're going through this conversation and this dialogue that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, has with an individual by the name of Muhammad ibn Abdullah. Now, Muhammad ibn Abdullah, he asks a series of questions, and we're kind of picking the most interesting questions, even though all of them are interesting. There's this one question that Muhammad ibn Abdullah asks His Eminence Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and that is that a man separates a part of his money with the intention of giving it to a brother in faith, a brother in iman, a fellow Muslim brother. But later on, that person learns that some people in his family are needful. And in such a situation, should the person pay the money to the former, which is the brother in faith, or to the latter, which is their family member? Now, it's interesting here that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, he says that whoever is more religious should be given preference. But then he kind of adds a caveat. He says that as the scholar has said, and I'm not sure who this scholar is that is being referred to here. And even in a previous program, we talked about a scholar being mentioned by Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. And even in that program, we weren't really sure who that scholar was because the name has not been given in either one of these answers. But His Eminence says that the scholar has said the Almighty Allah does not accept sadaqah, the giving of alms or this charity, until there remains some needy person in the family. Pay attention and distribute the money among the needy people in the family so that you obtain the merits of both. And so again, you know, as we have said, these are not certain jurisprudential commandments. You know, this is just one tradition, one question and answer session. And these are taken into consideration amongst the various other, traditions and verses of the Holy Quran and the other Islamic sciences in order to come to jurisprudential conclusions. We are not giving jurisprudential edicts or fatwas, you know, here on the program. We're just kind of, you know, checking out these questions and the answers and, you know, taking out interesting points. Yes, from what we know, the family members that are needy should be taken care of before, non-family members are taken care of. And, you know, ultimately, this is a system where if it is done all across the board, then nobody will remain poor. So if an individual focuses on their family and their immediate family and their near relatives in that sequential order in this circle, then the people in their circle start to become financially, you know, stronger. And then that other person who is poor, they should have a family member that is also helping them. And so these small circles, they grow and they increase the strength and the economic power of the Muslim Ummah in general. And it's a very orderly, you know, and very organized and orderly and disciplined manner of strengthening the economic status of the Muslims. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Mahdi, Ajalallahu Ta'ala, Farajahu Sharif. IRIB English Radio, our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The only thing that we can see is our well-being, our food, our job, our family, our children, their education, our education. That's it. The whole world could be at war. People are dying as they are right now. They're butchering people, burning them to death. All this is going on. People are being killed right here in the United States of America, being put in prison for no reason. People are not having meals in the state of Texas. I was given this. I don't know. I haven't been following up these statistics. I just know it's terrible. They were saying northern Texas, one in every four family is lacking one meal a day. That's a pretty high rate. They're struggling to find one meal, one in every four family. This is injustice. You have people living it up, don't know what to do with all that they have and sucking it up from the entire world. And these people are having trouble right here in the United States of America with finding food for their children. Okay, and we're just absolutely fine with that. As long as I'm okay, I have my job, I have my food, I have my shelter, I'm paying my bills, it's fine. What is going to mobilize a believer is moving towards that God-given human soul of ours that sees beyond this body and its needs. It looks at others.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Thank you for joining us. Hebrew Media focused on the course of the war of extermination and destruction in the Gaza City and on fears of escalating resistance operations there, while voices are rising, warning of sanctions that the European Union may impose on the Israeli entity. It also covered the messages sent by Hezbollah to the occupation on the anniversary of the Pagers bombings in Lebanon and the escalating media campaign against Qatar. These issues, we discuss them today with Dr. Jamal Wakim, Professor of History and International Relations, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Doctor.
Thank you.
The crimes of genocide waged by the occupation forces in the Gaza Strip and the incursions and destructions of homes and high-rise buildings in the city by the occupation army dominated discussions in Israeli studios. Analysts emphasized the difficulty of the battle and its repercussions on the Israeli entity. Roy Sharon speaks of several months, Doctor, as a time frame to occupy Gaza City because the occupation army, according to him, is advancing slowly towards the plan to occupy the city. What does this indicate?
Well, this indicates that it will be a long war. It will be a costly war for the Israelis on the human and hardware level. But at the same time, I believe that Netanyahu is insistent on taking over the city because he doesn't have in mind any political solution. He has a plan in mind, which is to exterminate the Palestinian people, expel the rest of them onto Sinai, and then move on to Gaza, to the West Bank, where he intends to get rid of millions of Palestinians alongside millions of Palestinians who reside within the Green Line, that is the territories occupied by Israel back in 1948. And this is part of a plan to ensure the Jewish identity of the Zionist entity, and it is also part of an attempt to redraw the geopolitical map of the region, especially of the Levant, in a way that could fit the Israeli aspirations for hegemony in the region.
Do you actually think that there is kind of a retreat in the statements, political statements concerning occupying Gaza City? There was a lot of excitement and enthusiasm at the beginning when they declared the operation. However, now, Doctor, they're speaking of several months in order, as a time frame, as I highlighted, in order to like occupy the city. And then they said that they are advancing slowly. Is this kind of like due to its inability to occupy the city massively or easily, well, the way that they advertised for it?
Well, I think this is from a military perspective, it's a very complicated task.
They didn't know the danger?
Of course they knew, and there were concerns raised by the Israeli chief of staff in the cabinet. However, the politicians insist on going through with this plan because they have ideological and geopolitical motives behind that. So the Israelis are facing mounting resistance by the Palestinians. They are entering into a trap in the city. So far we saw that in the first few hours, many soldiers, high-ranking soldiers, officers, got killed in ambushes and confrontations with the Palestinian resistance, and this could even go further in the future.
Escalate?
Definitely the resistance would escalate, and Israel doesn't have the luxury of time in the sense that it is trying to implement or, let's say, take advantage of a historical moment in order to implement all its plans, but time is not on its side. The more things take time, the more the resistance elements would gather forces, join forces in order to block the Israeli plans.
Okay. Despite the occupation army's announcement of starting the operation to occupy Gaza City that is accompanied by destruction, killing, and displacement of the city's residents, Hebrew media is still talking about disagreements between Chief of Staff Eyal Zamir and Netanyahu's administration regarding the operation to occupy Gaza City. Do you think that raising the dispute between Netanyahu and Zamir in Hebrew media is due to sensing the failure of the plan to occupy Gaza City, destroy Hamas, and also release the captives?
The Israeli chief of staff had concerns about the feasibility of the plan to occupy Gaza and, liberate the prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
Especially due to the fact that the Israeli army is bogged down in its operations against the resistance, and it's receiving heavy casualties at the hands of the resistance. So he had to brief the political leadership on the reality,
But his words weren't taken into consideration, Doctor. Why now raising the issue of the dispute between the two sides?
Yeah, because the political elite or political leadership was so persistent in pushing for this military operation with this regards to the security concerns of the chief of staff for the safety and security of his soldiers. So,
is it due to domestic pressure, in your opinion?
No, actually, it's due to the resistance, after all.
Okay.
Because the resistance is inflicting heavy casualties. And there are estimates that the toll of dead soldiers and injured will rise with the progress of the operation. So the chief of staff had to notify the leadership about this contingency. But their reaction was that they thought that he was trying to be hesitant in this regard, and that's why they attacked him. So now we have a breach between the political
apparatus and the army
on one hand and the army on the other hand. Yeah.
But bringing this subject to the surface, after trying as much as they can to decline his own concerns concerning this operation, at one point, do you see it as a failure to achieve the goals, or maybe they want a new scenario that to be applied?
Well,
or to
so
use it as a pretext to run to close the this plan?
No, no. The political leadership is consistent in its pursuit of this objective, and this this is of concern for the chief of staff, who sees the who has a clearer.
He expected this kind of resilience.
Yeah, definitely, and losses, and he was notifying them, warning them beforehand that this would be the result if you press for this operation. However, the political leadership, out of political concerns, ideological concerns, and geopolitical aspirations, disregarded all warnings by the chief of staff.
Would they take it into consideration now?
No, not at all.
Okay. Social media, however, reacted to the resistance operation that killed four soldiers in Rafah, and to Smotrich's call to divide Gaza Strip as real estate. Here are some of them.
Mako. The Israeli army continues investigating the explosion of the IED that led to the death of four soldiers in Gaza, despite the army's use of unmanned armored vehicles to detect IEDs and booby-trapped houses. Bariya. We're tired of your lies, Smotrich. You want to divide Gaza as real estate. That is the reason the attack on Gaza continues. Not to strike Hamas, not to return the captives, not even for security. Mayan Galili. If people are angry at Netanyahu, who turned us into Super Sparta, and at Smotrich's real estate dreams in Gaza, then do everything you can to stop the war immediately.
Voices are rising inside the Israeli entity over the EU's move to take a decision imposing economic sanctions on the entity because of the ongoing war crimes in Gaza. Now, commentators in Hebrew media consider this decision a very harsh blow to Israelis. Doctor, do you think that actually the EU will go ahead and impose sanctions on the Israeli entity? And if yes, why now?
Well, I believe that the EU will impose sanctions. Why now? I think because the EU is trying to part ways with the United States, have its own, let's say, approach mm-hmm. to what's going on in the Middle East, especially that it's so that its influence throughout the world eroded over the past two decades. So they are trying to recuperate what they have lost in the Levant, in our region, mm-hmm. by addressing the Arab public. And that's why they try to, let's say, go for this conference that called for two states. At the same time, they are coordinating with the various Arab states. And this is due to the fact that Israel chose to side fully with the United States.
So you're saying that there is a different policy between different policy concerning the Middle East from European and the Americans?
Yes, definitely. And the Europeans.
But they have been always supportive to the Israeli entity and its own plans, Doctor.
Yeah, I know.
What changed
but
now?
Actually, there is a concern by the Europeans of a major war in the region that would lead to the flow of immigrants.
After Israel hit Qatar, that's when they raised these concerns?
No, even before.
Or because of domestic pressure on them from their own society?
Even before the Europeans are concerned about the possibility of an outburst of a regional war that would push millions of illegal immigrants into Europe, which would destabilize the whole region. And they are saying that the United States is supporting Israel in its escalation, so that's why they try to pose as mediators. They try to, let's say, distinguish themselves from the U.S. stance in this regard. However, I don't believe that this will have much impact on the on Israel.
But the Europeans supported the war on Iran.
Yeah, definitely. That's a totally different thing.
Mm.
But they are trying to, let's say, find a solution for Palestine, let's say, because they fear that of the flow of immigrants to Europe. And at the same time, they saw that Israel is an ally of the United States that disregards European interests.
Okay.
However, this wouldn't affect much the Israeli economy because the Israeli economy benefits from the sponsorship of international financial centers all over the world
mm-hmm.
And of the full support of the United States. So I think that even if these sanctions would be imposed, they would have limited impact.
No devastating effects.
Yeah.
Okay. The pagers crime carried out by the Israeli occupation against Hezbollah in Lebanon 1 year ago was the subject of comments in Hebrew media. Roy Kais said that Hezbollah's commemoration of this operation is a message that it is still capable and continues to build its capabilities. Was the pager operation a turning point in the confrontation between Hezbollah and the Israeli entity, Doctor?
Well, to a certain extent, we should admit the fact that it was a blow to Hezbollah due to various, the Israelis could have achieved this, let's say, blow due to several factors. First, they fully enjoy the support of all intelligence services in the West,
mm-hmm.
Who manipulate, who exchange information and monitor people, etc. At the same time, we should also not underestimate the element of negligence, maybe. And this is something that should be dealt with for the future. However, despite this blow, and despite the many martyrs who fell, in addition to thousands of injured people, this didn't hinder the capabilities of Hezbollah to block the advance of the Israelis onto Lebanese territory. We remember the battles that ensued, especially in Khiyan and in the...
during the ground incursion, you're saying?
Yes, definitely. So, and meanwhile, I believe that Hezbollah is trying to learn from the lessons from the incursions. They, of course, they are coordinating this with other allies, but I believe that Hezbollah is resilient. It insists on, let's say, not raising the white flag, and to in order to continue the battle against Israel. And I believe that
yes.
this
okay.
is a mere, let's say, a mere phase mm-hmm. in a long confrontation with this enemy.
Okay. Now, the boasting in Hebrew media over the aggression against Qatar was accompanied by a fierce Israeli political and media campaign against Qatar, to the extent of labeling it a terrorist state that must be confronted. Do you think that the Israeli attack on Qatar has anything to do with Qatar relationships with Iran?
No, I don't think so. It only had to do with the attempts of Qatar to mediate a deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and Netanyahu doesn't want a political solution for the confrontation. He wants to continue the war, and that's why he targeted the negotiating team. Of course, in this act, he proved that he doesn't give any concern about Israel's relations with Qatar, noting that Qatar was among the first countries, Arab countries, to mend fences and normalize relations with Israel back in the, in 1995, for example. So, and this proves that Netanyahu wouldn't stop.
So this campaign signals another threat.
Yeah, it wouldn't stop his war, even if it would target allies of Israel in the region.
Unfortunately, our time is up. Dr. Jamal Wakim, a professor of history and international relations, thank you very much for joining us in today's episode.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. We're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
مالک یوم الدین بغل رب العالمینه چون رب العالمین الرحمن الرحیم.
The reason the word Malik is placed next to رب العالمین is significant because رب العالمین, Lord of all worlds, and الرحمن الرحیم, the most gracious, the most merciful, indicate God's compassion and nurturing. However, a nurturer must employ both fear and hope. He should not give so much hope that people dare to sin, nor should he frighten them so much that they despair. Fear, that means khawf, and hope, raja, must coexist. In Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, there is raja, or hope. Have hope, for God is the source of mercy. But immediately, we say, Malik Yawm al-Din, meaning the day of judgment, also exists. The Holy Quran places many such concepts side by side.
مثلا میگه انی انا الغفور الرحیم بعد میگه و ان عذابی هو العذاب العلیم.
For example, it says, indeed, I am the forgiving, the merciful, and then says, but indeed, my punishment is the painful punishment. Or it says, he is acceptor of repentance, but immediately adds, he is severe in punishment. Here too, after saying, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, we say, Malik Yawm al-Din. If in the previous phrase we said God is the source of mercy, in the next phrase we say God is the master of the day of judgment, meaning, so whoever does an atom's weight of good will see it, and whoever does an atom's weight of evil will see it. He is both the source of mercy, and we must also be mindful and cautious. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper-thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they
they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A new poll shows that President Donald Trump is losing the support of the largest unofficial political party in the United States, independent voters. A latest top survey found that 57% of all Americans now disapprove of Trump's performance, a record low for his second term. Trump's approval could fairly be said to be at its lowest point in either of his two terms. His net approval rating of minus 18 points is the second lowest ever recorded for him, and many pollsters disregard the accuracy of a minus 21 approval rating recorded in November 2017.
I think there's so much going on that it's really hard to even start. But one of the biggest things is he just keeps skirting the line of what's appropriate. And every single time that he gets closer to that line, getting towards inappropriate, he's just getting so close. And everyone knows the game that he's playing. And the game that he's playing is, how much can I get away with? And nobody likes that.
I didn't approve of him when he came in for the second term. Certainly his attacks on our freedoms, attacking organizations like this who are standing up and speaking against him. And, of course, what he's doing, under the guise of, undocumented immigration and detaining people without cause and just all the rhetoric.
Trump's low approval rating is also being attributed to the recent assassination of an Islamophobic but very popular right-wing commentator, which many are calling a watershed moment in increasingly violent American politics.
The assassination has led to increased calls for anti-Trump protesters to be stopped, arrested, investigated, and even deported. That has many accusing the administration of using McCarthyite tactics to silence freedom of speech.
I think a lot of people are afraid to come out. You know, you oppose Trump, you get primaried and knocked out of office, or you oppose Trump and you get a pizza sent to your house saying, I know where you and your wife and your kids live. And, you know, it's just total dictatorship.
Despite being the richest country in the world, inequality in America is so rampant that a recent study found that 67% of workers live paycheck to paycheck. That's an almost 7% increase since just last year, and the poll only represents people who are employed. Last week, jobless claims hit a four-year high. Polls show that price inflation and jobs are the two most important issues for voters. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Yemeni and Palestinian flags draped the 70 square as hundreds of thousands rallied in solidarity with Palestine, condemning U.S. and Israeli genocide in Gaza. Protesters also condemned Saudi Arabia and warned the kingdom of the dangers if it sides with Israel in any military operations against Yemen.
The Yemeni people are standing with Palestine against disgrace and humiliation. We are here in direct defiance against the U.S. and Israel, and we also send a warning to Saudi Arabia that if it gets involved in helping any of our enemies at sea, we will also deal with them.
Protesters also vowed that past Yemeni strikes prove Yemen's ability to hit back against Israel, U.S., and Saudi Arabia if necessary.
From this field of jihad, we tell the Zionists and the Americans that we will never fear your bombings on us. We will also send a message to those traitors, especially Saudi Arabia. Do not make the mistake of entering a battle you are not prepared for. Take heed of what we did to your Aramco facilities in the previous wars.
We condemn the failed Arab summit. They are only puppets of U.S. and Israel. We in Yemen stand firm as a mountain with our leader, and we will continue to attack by land, air, and sea against all enemies.
Yemenis are hoping for the best, but are preparing for the worst, an all-out battle with Israel and all its allies if the aggressions continue.
Yemen has stepped up its military operations, not only in support of Gaza, but to prevent what many believe is Israel's ultimate plan to take over parts of West Asia if the regime is not stopped immediately. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
Joint U.S.-South Korea military drills have dramatically increased in frequency in the last few years, especially near the DMZ. Residents want the disturbing and provocative drills to end, and they have some support at South Korea's National Assembly, where lawmakers push back on U.S. demands.
They're simultaneously pressuring South Korea to increase training and even send strategic weapons to South Korea. Therefore, peace on the Korean Peninsula can only be achieved by boldly rejecting these demands from the U.S. military and immediately halting military exercises.
Anti-U.S. sentiment has been on the rise in South Korea, also due to U.S. President Donald Trump's tariff extortion.
FTAs and free trade have long since disappeared, and the UN and WTO systems have also disappeared. What the U.S. is doing now is literally colonialism. We cannot give in here.
It was back in September of 2018 that South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un signed an agreement on measures to reduce tensions, particularly in the border areas. With a liberal leader back in office in Seoul, peace advocates want the 2018 deal renewed and drills to end.
Continuing these joint exercises will only serve to further fuel the fire and contribute nothing to peace. The South Korea-U.S. joint military exercises must be suspended, and the hostile and Cold War attitudes must be replaced with an attitude of dialogue and peaceful coexistence.
Calls for a stronger stance in relations with the U.S. president have been widely expressed in Seoul, underscoring public sentiment that the government should adopt a more assertive approach in its diplomatic dealings. South Korean President Lee Jae-myung is under public pressure here to take a firm stand on issues with the United States, as just days ago, some 300 high-tech workers were expelled from the U.S. President Donald Trump also demands $350 billion of investment from South Korea and for Seoul to drastically increase its military spending. On Monday, the U.S., South Korea, and Japan began another round of military drills in waters off of Jeju Island. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The relationship between the federal government in Baghdad and the Kurdistan regional government continues to swing between tension and compromise amid financial and economic complications that have yet to find a solution. But negotiation is still ongoing between the two sides.
Negotiations swing back and forth, sometimes with pressure on Erbil, other times on Baghdad. But the ultimate outcome depends on whether the region delivers its oil to the federal government in return for its full share of 12.67%. So far, however, the Kurdish stance remains unclear, both in interpreting the percentage and in its unilateral handling of oil sales.
The issue of oil export from the region through the Jihan port, which was supposed to resume at the capacity of around 400,000 barrels per day, remains on hold. Politically, there appear to be a temporary arrangement to keep matters moving until the upcoming elections, as the Kurdistan Democratic Party seeks to secure concessions through its role in parliamentary alliance and the formation of the new government.
There may be certain compromises by the government to keep matters moving forward, especially as we approach elections and the subsequent formation of a new government. The Kurdistan Regional Government, particularly the Kurdistan Democratic Party, appears to be seeking to secure certain privileges during this phase, both before and after the elections, by playing a role in the largest parliamentary coalition that nominates the prime minister and forms the new government.
With no decisive results from ongoing committees, the unresolved files are likely to face further delays until border political deal is reached. The relationship between Baghdad and Erbil has a long swung between tension and cooperation over oil budget and authority, making it one of the main challenges in Iraqi politics. The ongoing dialogue seen as strategic opportunity to preserve national balance. Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
The Iranian delegation attending the IAEA General Conference has held an event shedding light on the country's resolution that reaffirms the prohibition of attacks on nuclear facilities. The Venezuelan envoy to Vienna chaired the event.
Welcome to this side event organized by the Islamic Republic of Iran to address the issue of the attacks against nuclear sites and facilities, a serious threat to international peace and security, and to address its implications for the non-proliferation regime.
The event was addressed by some of the IAEA states, which co-sponsored it, such as China, Pakistan, and South Africa.
All the members, they should side with one side, which is preserving the NPT regime and IAEA safeguard regime. So let's work together to try to stand to side on the right side of history.
Given the grave consequences for population and the environment of any attacks on nuclear facilities, in our view, the space for attacks on nuclear facilities is non-existent.
Meanwhile, Russia called on Britain, France, and Germany, collectively known as the E3, to stop the snapback mechanism. The E3 triggered the mechanism in early August that would restore UN Security Council sanctions against Iran. The final deadline for a decision is September 27. The Russian envoy also criticized the U.S. and Israel for attacking Iranian nuclear sites in June.
What Israel and the United States did was the biggest blow to the IAEA safeguards system. The E3 should also stop the implementation of snapback mechanism in New York. Triggering snapback was illegal, politically irrelevant, and counterproductive.
Iran's permanent representative to the IAEA reiterated the illegality of the U.S. and Israeli attacks on the Iranian nuclear sites.
The attack on the Iran's nuclear facilities under the IAEA safeguard
is unprecedented in the history of the agency. This is the first time while the facility being under full scope safeguards of the agency and inspected on a daily basis. We had inspectors in all facilities almost all the time, and facilities been attacked by one non-party to the MPT and the other one, unfortunately, the depository of the MPT, which is the United States.
The U.S. delegation is meanwhile putting pressure on IAEA member states, particularly in the Western and North African regions, not to support the Iranian resolution.
In 1977, Amendments 1 and 2 of the Geneva Convention prohibited attacks and threats on nuclear facilities. But the U.S. are threatening to cut bilateral ties with countries if the Iranian resolution passes. A reckless behavior putting global security at risk. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
It all began with all the trappings of a traditional state visit. Horse-drawn carriage, royal pageantry, a formal greeting by the king, all behind the walls of this 11th century castle away from the public. But as the motorcade rolled, the marchers advanced in their thousands, a raucous sea of voices organized by the Trump Not Welcome coalition and allied groups, making their ire clear.
He's a rapist. He is a racist. He is enabling and funding a genocide in Palestine. He is a nightmare in all ways for the values of the UK. He is funding tax cuts for the super rich by taking away the health care of ordinary people in the United States. He's got his goons out on the street disappearing people and bundling them into the back of vans so that they vanish without a trace. He is a danger to democracy in the United States and to prosperity and peace around the world.
The visit comes hot on the heels of the far-right march in London this past week, seeing a common threat with Trump's rhetoric. The UK says ties with the US are vital for trade. For the protesters, the moral cost outweighs the political calculus.
See, the way some governments are behaving and our government is behaving is to get as close to Trump as they can in the hope of getting some crumbs from his table. You can sort of see that on the level of rationality of one country, but they are allowing, by doing that, they are empowering him to carry on behaving in all these sorts of terrible ways around the world. So I think there's an alternative where these countries in the world say to Trump, no, we're not having your tariffs.